integral f of x dx is the limit as delta goes to infinity, dx over delta, sum of f of x delta x. And it's funny because here we are again a year later and it's still appropriate to show. And I was at this skate park 2 days ago and it was still there. Okay, so I wanted to start with something where we can actually do everything on the board, do some sums, prove that we can do some maths. And we had this question about Hubble and the age of the universe. So the question was, you know, so we measure recessional velocities of galaxies, we put them on this linear fit, and it measures this thing called the Hubble constant. And the Hubble constant has units of inverse time, and if you just put one over the Hubble constant, you get something in units of time, and it happens to be the age of the universe. And the question was, why is this? Why does it work out that one over Hubble is the age of the universe? So it's actually fairly easy. So what is the Hubble constant H? It's A dot over A, and I'll explain what that is in a second. Dot is d by dt. A is the scale factor of the universe, so it's like, how do we measure distance as a function of time? So it's basically the rate of change of A divided by A, the relative rate of change of the scale factor of the universe, the relative rate of change of the size of the universe. Okay, that's what Hubble is. What do we mean by the age of the universe? Call it T0. What we mean is the integral from 0 up to T0 dt. Okay? And why is it integrals? Why is it dt? It's because general relativity is a differential theory. So everything's defined in terms of differentials. Now, how can we relate integral dt to h? Well, this is just the integral dA over AH. So here I've used the chain rule on integrals. So I've basically said that the integral dA by dt dt is the integral dA. I've rearranged that. That should be the way around. The integral dt by dA dA is the integral dt. Okay. So now we just need to integrate 1 over AH with respect to A. And 0 to T0, the scale factor is defined to be 0 at the Big Bang and 1 today. So that's when the universe was at 0 size and the universe is at size 1 today in some units.
Ah!
I can't move it. Front. Okay, there we go. Okay, so this isn't going to actually, so I'm going to use an approximation now. What am I going to do? So I'm going to define Hubble using what's called the Friedmann equation. This is like an elementary equation in cosmology. You get it from general relativity, and it says h squared is 8 pi g, g is Newton's constant, over 3 times the energy density of the universe, rho. What's the energy density? So this is where I'm going to make an approximation. I'm going to assume that the universe is made entirely of matter and a cosmological constant. So I'm ignoring curvature. Measurements from cosmic microwave background tell us curvature is approximately 0, so that's okay. I'm also going to neglect the radiation. And what that means, but the radiation only matters in the first few thousand years in the age of the universe. So our age of the universe is going to be off by a few thousand years, but that doesn't really matter. Okay, I'm going to do it without radiation just so we can compute the answer on the blackboard without having to use a computer. Okay. So the energy density, there's energy density in matter, rho m, and that is the energy density in matter today divided by a cubed. So when the universe is smaller, the matter gets denser with the volume. A measures length, so matter density scales like 1 over the volume. And then I said we also have the cosmological constant, rho lambda, and that's just rho lambda 0. It's a constant. It doesn't depend on A. Okay. Now, by rearranging this, we know that the total energy density today is 3 times h naught is the Hubble constant today, over 8 pi g. And now let me define some useful things that you might know that you might have heard of before. So let me define this thing called omega matter. That's the energy density in matter today divided by the total. And omega lambda, energy density and cosmological constant today, divided by the total. These are the two things that are measured in that famous cosmic pi, right? So we know that the universe is approximately 32% matter and approximately 68% dark energy, cosmological constant. They're these famous things that are measured. So we know these numbers. So now I can rearrange the Friedmann equation. H squared over H naught squared is just omega matter over A cubed plus omega lambda. Okay? So now we know that H is H naught times the square root of omega matter over A cubed plus omega lambda. And now we can do this integral. I've now written H in terms of A in every way that we can. And we can now just do the integral. Okay? So T0 is 1 over H naught, integral 0 to 1 dA, 1 over A square root omega matter over A cubed plus omega lambda. Okay, so that is the answer, but we're going to analyze it a little bit and figure out what it means. Notice 1 over H naught. So that is why the age of the universe is approximately 1 over H naught if the value of this integral is approximately 1. Okay, however close the value of this integral is to 1 is how good the approximation age of the universe is 1 over H naught is. And that's carrying the units, H has a unit 1 over time. Okay then, so first of all, let's do this in a case where it's really easy. Let's set omega lambda equals to 0. And omega matter equal to 1. Toy universe, it's called the Einstein de Sitter universe, where there's just matter. This is, and when omega matter is equal to 1, this is just a really easy integral. It's just an integral of a power of A. Okay, so you can do it. So it's just 1 over H naught, integral 0 to 1 dA, A to the half. And that is just 2 over 3 H naught, A to the 3 halves evaluated on 0 to 1. And that's just 2 over 3 H naught. So in an entirely matter universe, the age of the universe is 2 thirds times 1 over H naught. So 1 over H naught is a pretty good guess. In the real world, where omega lambda is 0.68 and omega matter is 0.32, you can still do this integral. It's a hyperbolic sign. It's a bit of a messy thing to do on the board, so we won't do it. I just asked Mathematica. But you can do it, it's a hyperbolic sign. You can evaluate it, you put in those numbers, and T naught is equal to 0.94677 over H naught. So it's even closer to 1 over H naught because we've got lambda. Because omega lambda is not 0, it's even closer. And this tells us two important things. The fact that the age is 1 over H naught is essentially luck. It just happens to be. If the universe was not made of just matter and a cosmological constant, the age would not be proportional to 1 over H naught. It's a good approximation. And also, you notice that if I keep H naught fixed, introducing lambda has made the universe older by a factor of about a third. So when people say, you know, one of the evidences for the cosmological constant is that the universe is really old, that's why. So that's why people knew really that the cosmological constant was non-zero actually before the supernova data, because people looked at the ages of globular clusters and saw that they were older than this. Because they knew what H naught was, roughly, and they saw that globular clusters needed the universe to be about this age, not this age. The supernovae were just kind of the nail in the coffin. Okay, so that was the first question that I wanted to answer. Why is the universe 1 over H naught?
One question.
How
do you differentiate between the dark matter and the matter which is there?
So this total matter is dark matter plus atoms plus baryons.
How do you know that there's no dark matter in the matter which is there? 0.32.
That's including both. That's dark matter plus baryons. Both of them, because they're both matter, all that matters in this equation is that they behave like this, 1 over a cubed, which just means that they're cold matter.
So that point C2 is a combination of both dark matter as well as the matter which is there, and the point 6 is only dark matter?
Is only dark energy, lambda, the cosmological constant. Is this how Hubble did it? To get the age of the universe? Yeah, he would have known this equation. So yeah, this is the Friedman equation. Friedman was like, I don't know, like mid-1920s, I think, and Hubble was like 1930s or so. So yeah. So the next question that this leads us on to, which I'm gonna show a little video for, is the question was, what are the theories for, here we are, the death of the universe. So first of all, let me explain a little bit about the Friedman equation. So the Friedman equation tells you how A evolves with time, how the scale factor evolves with time. I said I ignored curvature. Curvature, if the universe is positively curved, it appears with a minus sign on here. So that means that if curvature comes to dominate, the rate of change of the scale factor can become negative and the universe can turn over and crunch back. When lambda comes to dominate, because matter's going as 1 over a cubed and lambda's not changing at all, eventually the universe will become so big that the matter becomes diluted and the cosmological constant can win. That's what we think will happen. And then the universe just starts expanding really, really quickly. You can then solve this and a grows exponentially for omega lambda. So these are the kind of things that the matter, what the energy density in the universe and how it behaves with A determines how the scale factor evolves, and that's what we mean by the fate of the universe. So I'm going to show you a video and then we'll talk about it a bit. If it loads, which it isn't. Okay. Fresh. So this is a video actually that that my girlfriend made. And we don't have sound. Oh dear. See if this gives us some sound. Can you hear that? Is it coming out of the speakers?
Amazed by how it seems to go.
Okay, we're gonna go back to the beginning. So my girlfriend Renee is also an astrophysicist and she's a TED fellow and she made this video with TED. It's about 5 minutes long, so let's watch this and think about the death of the universe.
Looking up at the night sky, we are amazed by how it seems to go on forever. What will the sky look like billions of years from now?
A particular type of scientist, called a cosmologist, spends her time thinking about that very question. The end of the universe is intimately linked to what the universe contains. Over 100 years ago, Einstein developed the theory of general relativity, formed of equations that help us understand the relationship between what a universe is made of and its shape. It turns out that the universe could be curved like a ball or sphere. We call this positively curved or closed. Or it could be shaped like a saddle. We call this negatively curved or open. Or it could be flat. And that shape determines how the universe will live and die. We now know that the universe is very close to flat. However, the components of the universe can still affect its eventual fate. We can predict how the universe will change with time if we measure the amounts or energy densities of the various components in the universe today. So what is the universe made of? The universe contains all the things that we can see, like stars, gas, and planets. We call these things ordinary or baryonic matter. Even though we see them all around us, the total energy density of these components is actually very small, around 5% of the total energy of the universe. So now let's talk about what the other 95% is. Just under 27% of the rest of the energy density of the universe is made up of what we call dark matter. Dark matter is only very weakly interacting with light, which means it doesn't shine or reflect light in the way that stars and planets do. But in every other way, it behaves like ordinary matter. It attracts things gravitationally. In fact, the only way we can detect this dark matter is through this gravitational interaction, how things orbit around it, and how it bends light as it curves the space around it. We have yet to discover a dark matter particle, but scientists all over the world are searching for this elusive particle, or particles, and the effects of dark matter on the universe. But this still doesn't add up to 100%. The remaining 68% of the energy density of the universe is made up of dark energy, which is even more mysterious than dark matter. This dark energy doesn't behave like any other substance we know at all and acts more like anti-gravity force. We say that it has a gravitational pressure, which ordinary matter and dark matter do not. Instead of pulling the universe together, as we would expect gravity to do, the universe appears to be expanding apart at an ever-increasing rate. The leading idea for dark energy is that it is a cosmological constant. That means it has the strange property that it expands as the volume of space increases to keep its energy density constant. So, as the universe expands, as it is doing right now, there will be more and more dark energy. Dark matter and baryonic matter, on the other hand, don't expand with the universe and become more diluted. Because of this property of the cosmological constant, the future universe will be more and more dominated by dark energy, becoming colder and colder and expanding faster and faster. Eventually, the universe will run out of gas to form stars, and the stars themselves will run out of fuel and burn out, leaving a universe with only black holes in it. Given enough time, even these black holes will evaporate, leaving a universe that is completely cold and empty. That is what we call the heat death of the universe. While it might sound depressing, living in a universe that will end its lifetime cold and devoid of life, the end fate of our universe actually has a beautiful symmetry to its hot, fiery beginning. We call the accelerating end state of the universe a de Sitter phase, named after the Dutch mathematician Willem de Sitter. However, we also believe that the universe had another phase of de Sitter expansion in the earliest times of its life. We call this early period inflation, where, shortly after the Big Bang, the universe expanded extremely fast for a brief period. So, the universe will end in much the same state as it began, accelerating. We live at an extraordinary time in the life of the universe, where we can start to understand the universe's journey and view a history that plays itself out on the sky for all of us to see.
So, that is the fate of the universe. The heat death and the Sitter space. Everything that we currently know from the cosmic microwave background and from all of cosmological observations say that that's what's going to happen. Anything else is pure speculation. We can maybe talk about the pure speculation later, but everything we know says that the universe says that there's a cosmological constant. That's just going to win in the expansion. There is nothing else that will win. Everything else gets diluted. Cosmological constant wins, and it just empties the universe. And then eventually, all the stars die. Everything goes into a state of very high entropy, and the universe is empty, and it's the heat death. So, but it's great because there's this symmetry between the early universe and the late universe. The early universe, we think, also began in De Sitter. That's what would have happened in inflation. And in eternal inflation, the whole universe is just really, really De Sitter space, and we're just a little pocket where the De Sitter expansion has stopped for a small amount of time, and we happen to have some matter around. So it's actually very nice and symmetric. De Sitter space is one of the most symmetric solutions of Einstein's equations. So it's all very nice, really. Okay, so the next question that I wanted to answer was related to gravitational lensing and dark matter. So I think the question was along the lines of, so we see dark matter from gravitational lensing, and we also see it in the rotation curves of galaxies. And are these two things consistent with each other? Okay, so I want to actually say the most important thing is the cosmic microwave background. That's the thing we should be asking about consistency with. Rotation curves of galaxies, it's kind of like, you know, the historic way we think of dark matter having been discovered by Vera Rubin and co. But really, the current best evidence for dark matter is the cosmic microwave background. It's the gold standard in cosmology. And you can't fit the cosmic microwave background unless you have a large amount of dark matter. So really, we should be saying, is gravitational lensing, it's kind of our modern way of looking at dark matter, consistent with the CMB? But I'm going to draw some pictures, and then I'm going to show you some fancier pictures on the slides. So first of all, let's actually look at that orbital speeds thing that I mentioned. So the classic story there is that Like, here's the orbital speeds, here's the distance in, say, the inner galaxy. If all we had was the stars that we observe, this would have a shape like this. It's called the Keplerian velocity profile. What we actually observe is something more like this. So the velocity curve remains straight. So that means there's got to be some extra matter in the outer regions of the galaxy, puffed up in what we call a halo that supports this. I mean, eventually, and there's like, you know, there's data points like, excuse me, like this. I mean, eventually, of course, the dark matter will also die away in a Keplerian. But the original observations weren't up to very large R. So this is what people say with rotation curves. So this, we can't compare this to this number 0.32, because this measures the local density of dark matter. It doesn't measure the whole density in the universe. So what this measures is this measures like the kind of shape of the dark matter density profile in the galaxy. And you know, you can, this is like some function of radius. The density is a function of radius in the galaxy. And you can write this as like, you know, a function, and you can fit its parameters. You can fit some function here to the data, because galaxies are approximately spherically symmetric, and you can say, okay, you haven't actually measured the density, but you've measured the shape of the dark matter distribution in the galaxy. In lensing, in gravitational lensing, it's a little bit more complicated than this. You can't assume spherical symmetry because, you know, in something like the Bullet Cluster, you know, it's not spherically symmetric, right? It's got these two big things. But what you can do is you can still use the lensing information to map out where the dark matter is and what its density is. So this is this like famous picture of the Bullet Cluster. This is the X-ray gas, and then the blobs are gravitational lensing showing you where the dark matter is. Again, I don't think this is our current best evidence for dark matter. It's evidence for dark matter, but it's got nothing on the CMB. So now we can say, okay, lensing, you can't assume spherical symmetry, but you can map out the dark matter. But this is again just one cluster of galaxies. We can't say, does this add up to 0.32? Okay. But what you can do is people can take surveys, lensing surveys of the entire universe. So you map huge portions of the sky and create lensing maps like this and add up all the matter that you see and see if it adds up to 0.32. A map like that looks like this. This is a map from the Dark Energy Survey. It's just a name. It's not actually mapping dark energy. It's just mapping the universe. It maps galaxies, and it maps the lensing of galaxies. And this is a map of a huge portion of the sky. So these are galactic coordinates, right ascension and declination. No, they're not galactic coordinates. They're terrestrial coordinates, I think. Okay, so this is 100 million light years, and these are locations of galaxies, and the map is the location of the dark matter. So red, there's more dark matter. Blue, there's less. And from measurements like this, from weak lensing measurements, I just looked up a recent paper by a woman called Netta Bacall, who's kind of famous for this kind of thing. And she said that from weak lensing, we know that omega matter is 0.26 plus or minus 0.02. Okay, so we always need to compare errors because we're scientists. What did Planck actually tell us there? The CMB told us that omega matter is 0.315 plus or minus 0.017. So there's errors on both of these. And normally we allow things to vary by plus or minus twice their error, and we don't worry. That's called plus or minus 2 sigma. These are like standard deviations, assuming these are Gaussian distributions. And so if you add 2 sigma to this, it's 0.3. If you take 2 sigma from this, it's 0.28. They're consistent within 2 sigma. They're not bang on consistent with each other, but they're consistent within 2 sigma. So we can just add up all the mass that we see from weak lensing, and it adds up roughly to all the mass that we see in the CMB. So the measurements are consistent, but you may worry, you know, they're kind of 1-2 sigma apart. If you're a statistician, you shouldn't worry about that, but you're a physicist and you like to dream. So we do worry about that. another way to think about that, so this is a plot from Planck, the cosmic microwave background experiment, and omega matter here, the fractional energy density in matter, and then there's this thing called sigma 8, which is the amplitude of fluctuations in the cosmic microwave background, essentially. And so Planck makes this measurement in the black. They measure the amplitude very well and omega matter very well. So omega matter there, the black is centered on about 0.32. But then the other lines, the blue, the green, and this sweep of dots are measurements from weak lensing. And so you see here how that tension in weak lensing works out. So these are actually here, the weak lensing alone is just the red, just the dots, and that's kind of preferring, there's most of the density of the dots around like 0.2 something. Okay, so that's preferring a slightly lower value of omega matter, but it doesn't measure omega matter directly, it measures only like this combination of omega matter, sigma 8. Then they include some other data along with the weak lensings, BAO, baryon acoustic oscillations, etc. And that pulls that data a little bit over here. So omega matter remains about consistent at 0.32 in these greens and these blues. But sigma 8, the amplitude of fluctuations, is slightly lower than we think from the CMB. So really this this small tension between the measurements of the total amount of dark matter isn't actually a tension in the amount of dark matter. It's really attention to the amplitude of fluctuations. Because weak lensing, you know, how they measure omega matter, it's like they count the number of big blobs versus small blobs. And really it's that they're all of a uniformly lower amplitude, but they still add up to the same amount once you include some constraints. So I said, we're theorists, we like to dream. What could explain this? Something that might go into this, this is just kind of showing you what we look at every day and what we think of. This is like another version of that plot, sigma 8, omega matter. And here the author is now allowing for a component of massive neutrinos. He's giving the neutrinos mass. Neutrinos have mass, they act like hot dark matter because they're very light compared to the cold dark matter and they're relativistic. And so when things are hot, that wipes out structure, it lowers sigma 8. He's showing the lensing is in gray, and Planck, including neutrinos, is, plus his analysis, is this like oranges and greens. And so the neutrinos can kind of do something to resolve that tension. So dark matter does add up to what we see, slightly off. The slight off could be that we're really seeing the effect of mass, of the mass of the neutrino in cosmology, which is pretty cool. So that was gravitational lensing and dark matter. Yes, it adds up and it works well at the CMB. I'm firing through these questions, but there's a lot to say. Okay, so dark matter and volume. Yes.
You're looking at the discourse image because of the lensing, but in order to calculate the lensing, you have to know what the Gregorian was looking before it was distorted.
Right.
How do you know that?
So in the CMB, there's a way we know that because we know the statistics of the CMB. So gravitation, so this, we think that the CMB was this like uniform, what we call Gaussian random field. And lensing makes it non-Gaussian. It amplifies hotspots and it de-amplifies cold spots in a particular way. So in the CMB, we can measure gravitational lensing from the statistics. And again, in galaxies, you measure it statistically. So the weak lensing there is what's called a weak lensing shear measurement. So lensing makes galaxies slightly brighter, but it also shears them. So it makes them, if they were a circle, a slight shear. Now, you can't measure an overall amplification. You can't measure the magnification. We don't really know the intrinsic brightness of galaxies. But you can measure the shear. You might say, okay, well, we don't know the intrinsic shape either. But you can look for statistical effects. So we might not. So we might see one galaxy sheared, and then if a bunch near it are all sheared in the same direction, if it was just random orientations, there's a very low probability of that happening. But if there's a lens in front of it, and that's causing a coherent shearing, we can measure that. So it's all measured statistically. You don't know the for galaxies, you don't know the intrinsic properties, but you can correlate properties that they wouldn't be correlated unless there was a lens doing the correlating. So that's how we get it. Okay, dark matter and volume. The question was, does dark matter take up a volume? And the answer is yes, of course it does. Why does that feel somehow unintuitive, maybe? When things normally take up volumes like this, how do we know they take up a volume? The way I know how that takes up a volume is because it interacts with electromagnetism. That's the reason I don't fall through the floor. It's got nothing to do with gravity. The solidness of things has nothing to do with gravity. It's all just electromagnetism. You know, the electrons in my feet repel me from the floor. That's how I know that things take up volume. Dark matter doesn't interact with electromagnetism. It's dark. That's what we know about it. But it still takes up a volume, but you just have to measure that volume not using like electromagnetism. Okay? So you can measure it using things like this. Using rotation curves, I said, you can measure the local density of dark matter. And let's write it down and do a couple of sums and kind of think about this. What am I the plots? Okay. So you know that you know the density of dark matter, you know how much there is in a particular volume. So that's like a measure of the, you know, that's what you think of with volume. It's like how much mass is there in a particular space. Okay, so the local density of dark matter measured from rotation curves of stars, orbital velocities within the Milky Way. The local density of dark matter is 8 times 10 to the minus 3 solar masses per cubic parsec. What does that mean in ordinary language? So a solar mass is, and you know you can ask Google to do all this for you. Google will convert like grams into solar masses and parsecs into centimeters and all this kind of stuff. Google's brilliant. Google's brilliant. Okay, so, and if you want to do even fancier ones like this, like Wolfram Alpha does stuff like that. Although I use Google. Okay, so solar mass is about 10 to the 33 grams. A parsec is about 10 to the 18 centimeters. So you can work out what the density is in grams per centimeter cubed. It's 6 times 10 to the minus 25 grams per centimeter cubed. Let's compare that to some other things that we might know. So the mass of the proton is about 10 to the minus 24 grams, Wikipedia. And let's like make some kind of guess about this lecture hall. It's about 20 meters that way, maybe 20 meters that way, or maybe 5 meters that way. Okay? So we can work out from the dark matter density, what's the equivalent number of protons in this lecture hall? And it's approximately, if the dark matter was the mass of the proton, there would be about 10 to the 9 particles in this lecture hall. So it's about 10 to the 9 particles per lecture hall. Okay, how can you compare that to something that you know? Well, hydrogen, 1 gram of hydrogen has hydrogen's one proton. 1 gram of hydrogen has Avogadro's number of protons, 10 to the 23 protons. So it's a lot less dense than hydrogen, right? But and I don't vouch for the ultimate accuracy of my units conversion there. This is right, and these are right. But you could check the units conversion. Okay, so dark matter does take up a volume, but what about the individual dark matter particles? What do we know about the volume that they take up? Okay, well now it depends on what your model for the dark matter is. So, which order shall we do this in? Let's assume that dark matter isn't a fundamental particle. Let's imagine that it's like clumps of stuff, like planets going around. These things are called machos, they're massive compact halo objects. And you can ask if we see them. And again, they do this from gravitational lensing. It's something called microlensing. You look at stars, and if there were a whole bunch of like massive compact halo objects moving around, they'd every now and again pass in front of stars, and you'd see this like microlensing effect, this like statistical kind of noise of the star brightness going up and down. And To the extent that we don't see that, people can constrain whether or not dark matter is made of macros. And this is what such a constraint might look like. So they can say, how much of the total mass of our dark matter halo is in machos as a function of the macho mass in solar masses? So you see that over a wide range of masses between, you know, about 100 solar masses down to about 10 to the minus 8 solar masses, the dark matter can be at most a few percent in machos, because we don't see this microlensing that would happen if the dark matter was machos. So that's one thing. We know that dark matter isn't made of big lumps between this range of masses. So what if the dark matter is a particle then? What if it's a fundamental particle? Well, then the notion of volume, of size that we should have is the de Broglie wavelength. So you know the de Broglie wavelength of a particle is 1 over the mass times the volume times the velocity. The local velocity in the galaxy is something called the virial velocity. We have this theorem called the virial theorem that tells you how fast particles in equilibrium should be moving in a gravitational potential around something of a given mass. So we know the mass of the galaxy. We know the approximate velocity of like things in thermal equilibrium from this thing called the virial theorem. And that is of order 100 kilometers per second. So you can ask for a particle of a given mass, roughly how big is it in like quantum mechanical terms? What is the uncertainty on its location? It turns out if the dark matter is something like the mass of the proton, this would be what are called WIMPs, weakly interacting massive particles, WIMPs and machos. You can see we have a sense of humor. If the dark matter is something like the mass of a proton, which is a WIMP, in particle physics units, this is a GeV, giga electron volt, and that's that 10 to the minus 27 kilograms, then this is really small. They're essentially point-like. I mean, all particles, you know, like in the lab right here, you know, if we got a particle, it would be essentially point-like. So then the particles themselves essentially take up zero volume. But there's another possibility, which is very dear to my own heart. And that's if, well, what if the dark matter is super, super light? How light can we make it? How small can we make this number? And how big can we make the like quantum effect of the dark matter? Okay. Well, it turns out that if we make the mass we can make the mass 31 orders of magnitude lighter than the mass of the proton, and it'd still be consistent with everything we know. So this would be what are called axion-like particles. They're like it's like a very, very light form of dark matter. And then this lambda de Broglie could be of order a kiloparsec. Now, the Milky Way galaxy is about 250 kiloparsecs across. So pretty big, actually, compared to the size of the galaxy. You might say, how does this compare to these type of constraints? Well, you've got to work a little bit harder because you've got to solve some field equations, you've got to do some simulations and all of this. This is kind of what the results of having such a really light particle with its own large quantum mechanical volume look like. So this is like a simulation done by this group in Taiwan. This is like a knot in the cosmic web. So you see these pictures, I should have had one, of the cosmic web, you know, these simulations of like galaxy formation and galaxies live on these filaments and all of this, and it looks like what we see in something like the Sloan Digital Sky Survey. This is a zoom in on the cosmic web in a model where the dark matter is really, really light. And it kind of clumps together into these little dense objects, these cores, and you'd have a whole lot of dark matter particles all sitting together, gravitationally bound, but the average size of such a core is set by the de Broglie wavelength of order a kiloparsec. So in a model like this, the dark matter can be like kind of large and take up large volumes, and it's like this wave-like quantum mechanical effect. And I work on this myself, this model, and this is a plot from a review that I'm putting out on a model like this. So this is the mass of this particle in units of 10 to the minus 22 electron volts. That's 31 orders of magnitude lighter than the proton. And here we've tried to use that size, that actual quantum mechanical size of the dark matter particle, to explain observations of dwarf galaxies in the Milky Way. So his Fornax and Sculptor, Ursa Minor, and a difference analysis of Fornax. And so these dwarf galaxies are actually observed to have very flat, very like uniform, dense dark matter cores in the middle, which you wouldn't get in a model where the dark matter is something like the mass of the proton. But you can explain that large flatness from those lumps that you saw in the picture before. And if you want to do that, it selects a mass for you. So this is the likelihood, this is the probability that the dark matter is of a particular mass. And in this model, there you pick this preferred mass of about 31 orders of magnitude lighter than the proton. So, and this model happens to make a whole bunch of other predictions, and it's very dear to my heart, and I work on it a lot. So that matter could have a size. And so, yeah, it could have a size, it could have a volume, depends on what your model for dark matter is. And we can put constraints on these things. That's always the important thing. I mean, you can't just ask a question and, like, you know, say, does it have a size? You've got to have an observation that tests that. And one of the things we use is microlensing. Another thing we use is the observed distribution of dark matter within galaxies. So here, the measurement we actually used was a measurement of the projected velocity of stars within these dwarf galaxies. So Fornax and Sculptor are like, Ursa Minor sits in the constellation of Ursa Minor. Fornax and Sculptor like orbit in the southern plane of the galactic hemisphere. They're things orbiting our own galaxy. And we use the velocities of stars within them to weigh them, and to weigh them as a function of their radius. So we map out the profile of the dark matter, just like in that sketch before, using the rotation curves, you do that. You do it in a slightly different way in a dwarf galaxy, but it's kind of similar. I would like it very much if the dark matter did have a size, and if its size was about a kiloparsec and it was this mass. That would be very good. Okay, so we've got 15 minutes. I've got one more main question to do, and then a couple more things that I'm just going to like comment on a bit. So the next one I was going to do mainly is black hole spins. So there was a question, can black holes spin? If so, what does this mean? And the answer is yes. So black holes, so you might have heard these names, right, are a solution of Einstein's equations called the Schwarzschild solution. Very famous solution of Einstein's equations. I think Schwarzschild, like he found it when he was fighting in the trenches in World War I or something. Sorry, he's pretty hardcore. But there's another solution of Einstein's equations called the Kerr solution, which is really famous. And it's also a black hole, but it's a spinning black hole. What does a spinning black hole mean? Well, what does spin mean? I mean, okay, if something's like actually spinning, I can go up and touch it and feel that it's moving around. But how do we measure spin? We measure something is spinning from its angular momentum. Angular momentum is like, you know, completely this fundamental, awesome thing. It's conserved. It tells us about the rotational symmetries of the universe. We think angular momentum is like really fundamental. So at the same time, when we say that like an electron has spin, what we mean that it has angular momentum. And these Kerr solutions, these black hole solutions, have angular momentum. And what's another consequence of that? Well, angular momentum, you kind of remember, you know, it's measured by the right-hand rule, right? If you have some angular momentum, you do this and you say, oh, angular momentum is pointing in a certain direction. What that means is that the Schwarzschild space-time has no preferred direction. The black hole isn't spinning, you can't orientate yourself, it's just completely spherically symmetric. But the Kerr space-time has a preferred direction defined by the spin. So one, it has angular momentum, which you can measure. And two, it defines a preferred direction. And the question is, okay, it's theoretical. I know we're in a theoretical physics institute, but I like observations. So how could we possibly know if black holes actually out there in the universe have spin? And this is that we can measure them. So this is a picture from NASA of some particular black hole that I just found on Google. Again, I did my homework this morning. So this is some black hole, J1644, and this is a picture of it. And the important thing here is this innermost, two important things. One is that there's this jet And we see these things in black holes all the time. They shoot out energy along some axis. The only way you can define an axis, I said Schwarzschild doesn't care. It's spherically symmetric. Spin defines an axis in a direction. So already, it's defined a direction, so it's probably spinning. The way that you measure its spin is by this thing called the innermost stable circular orbit, the ISCO. So black holes have these accretion disks around them, and at some point the accretion disk stops, and everything within that orbit falls in to the black hole. It's not the event horizon, but it's like if you put things on orbits, there is no stable orbit smaller than this radius. And that's a property of the Kerr solution. And so by measuring the radius of the innermost stable circular orbit, you can measure the spin. I don't know what the formula is because I don't work on this stuff directly, but basically this radius is a function of the spin. So you measure the radius, you can measure the spin. And in this case, you see that they have measured the size of this ISCO, the innermost stable circular orbit, 2.5 to 5.8 million miles across. And this is a black hole of mass. Oh, this is really heavy, right? This is a supermassive black hole. 450,000 to 5 million times the sun's mass, 10 to the 6 solar masses. So this is a supermassive black hole at the center of some galaxy, and they've measured its mass and its spin. This is actually an interesting story now that relates to work of another of a professor here at Perimeter and to my own work that I was just telling you about with these light dark matter particles. So Meena Ravanataki, who's a young professor here, she works on this stuff that uses the spins of black holes to tell us about the mass of dark matter particles when they're really light, like I was telling you about. So this is a plot from one of her recent papers. And what they're showing here is this is for a mass of a particle. Here it's 10 to the minus 11 electron volts. That's 11 plus 9. That's 20 orders of magnitude lighter than the proton. And these blue, and this is the black hole spin on the left axis, measured in some units that go from 0 to 1. Black holes actually have a maximum spin, just like there's a maximum speed of light. And so you can measure stuff in units of that. So the spin is in units 0 to 1. Black hole mass in solar masses, 5 solar masses, 10, 15. The blue curves in this particular model of dark matter, no black holes inside the blue curves should exist. Now, the reason is fairly complicated due to something called black hole superradiance. But let's just take it as red. Black holes should not exist in that blue area if the dark matter is a particle of this mass. Now, the points are observations of black holes, just like the one I showed you before, but now for solar mass black holes, not supermassive black holes. And so you see that we see some black holes of mass, say 11 solar masses, and spinning very fast, spin of 0.8, spin of nearly 1. We see these solar mass black holes that are rapidly spinning. And so that tells you that that matter cannot be a particle of this mass, because then those black holes could not exist. So you can use the spins of black holes to constrain the mass of the dark matter particle using this thing called black hole superradiance. And this is like a more detailed version of Meena's plot. So here she's used five different, in the top one, she's used five measurements of solar mass black holes to rule out a range of masses. So forget what the y-axis is, just look at the size of the blue region. And this is a log plot. So she's constrained she's ruled out masses of dark matter particles over about two orders of magnitude in this particular light region. So all the blue is not allowed because of those observations of solar mass black holes. In the bottom plot, she's used observations of supermassive black holes like that JG1644 or whatever that I showed you. She hasn't used that one exactly, but she's used observations of some other spinning supermassive black holes to rule out another range of masses of particles. So this is now in the orange. And then the reason I wanted to show you these plots, they're probably a little bit confusing, is that what I showed you before, in order to explain these slopes of dwarf galaxies, we needed a mass about 10 to the minus 22 electron volts. That's the 31 orders of magnitude lighter than the proton. These supermassive black holes exclude masses in the range of about 10 to the minus 16 to 10 to the minus 18. So supermassive black holes exclude, let's just write 1 down, 10 to the minus 18 EV. So, you know, these aren't too far away in scale. I mean, considering Mina's, by using observations of black holes, already covered about 7 or 8 orders of magnitude in particle mass here from minus 11 to minus 18. For another 4 orders of magnitude isn't that far. And so, you know, by pushing constraints from the dark matter profiles of galaxies, we can try and push this mass to meet this mass. And by observing more black holes, we can kind of try and make these two observations meet. So this would be from like galaxies and structure. Give you like a scale, supermassive black holes, give you another scale, and you can try and close this gap. So you can like close a gap on a whole range of models of dark matter where it takes up a size, it takes up a volume, like we were discussing before. So that is what I had to say about black hole spins and the volume of dark matter. They were all of the questions that I prepared detailed answers for, but there are a couple of others that I was just going to comment on. Someone had this question about how do we know, like, could I explain why fermions that have spin 1/2 need to be rotated through 720 degrees before they come back to themselves, whereas I only have to rotate 360 degrees. I would love it if I could give a wonderful explanation of that, but I can't. But I know who can, and I know where you can get the good explanation. Just Feynman. In the Feynman lectures on physics, he probably has a great explanation of this, and I'm pretty sure there's even videos of his lectures on the character of physical law where he probably explains this too. So I would say go and look up some Feynman stuff and be amused and amazed, and he'll explain that to you.
Or just think of it as a Möbius strip, which works enough for kids.
Right, and there's this kind of thing where you can hold something in your hand as well, right? But I don't know like what the physical origin of that is. So there's this thing where, you know, if I rotate my arm through 360 degrees, I'm not back at myself. But if I go through 720 degrees, it comes back. So it's kind of, that's like the one that people say. They say, okay, here's something where I can show you that I have to rotate it through 720 degrees. But I don't know why that has anything to do with particles. There are like examples where it can happen. Like, I mean, like you say, like this Möbius strip, but I don't know why that relates to particles. Why like me holding a glass has anything to do with that. But Feynman probably knows. There was another question about relativity and mass. So it was like, okay, you know, we tell students when things approach the speed of light, their mass increases. And then if this gets high enough, would they kind of form a black hole? And would there be like an event horizon? Well, first of all, I think that when we say relativity increases the mass of things is very, very misleading. It does not. The mass doesn't change. The mass is an invariant property, like because velocity doesn't matter. I can just always imagine that I'm standing still, and then I can always measure my mass in my own frame of reference, and it never changes. It's an invariant. What actually changes is the inertia. So if you kind of, if you want to define mass as, you know, in F equals ma, so that it always looks like that, then yes, m is changing. But what's really changing is your ability to accelerate something. So really, there's just this gamma here, which is an additional inertial factor. It's harder to accelerate things. That doesn't mean their mass changes. So I think it's misleading to say that the mass changes. But there is an event horizon that can happen here. So I said velocity isn't real. Like relative velocity is real, but velocity fundamentally isn't real, because I can just always imagine that I'm standing still and everything else is moving. Acceleration is fundamentally real, and that's what Einstein realized in general relativity. So if a particle is accelerating, I have to put in more and more energy to accelerate it more and more as it approaches the speed of light. And there is a kind of event horizon that happens there. I don't have like a great explanation for it, but I can give you the word and you can look it up if you're interested. It's something called the Rindler horizon. And it does radiate, even Hawking radiates like black hole horizons do. Or I think it's called Unruh radiation. Bill Unruh is another visiting professor here. I think it's called Unruh radiation from the Rindler horizon. And you can kind of imagine it like, so what we're talking radiation, it's the particles are like randomly pair created by quantum mechanics at the horizon of the black hole. One falls in, one comes out. And the one that falls in extracts some energy from the black hole and we see the one that comes out. The same thing happens as you're accelerating. If you're accelerating towards the speed of light, as you approach the speed of light, there are particles like in your frame of reference. So now you can really tell that you're accelerating because acceleration is real. There are quantum pair created particles that some will just fall away from you and they can never catch you up because they started slightly moving away from you and they can't go faster than the speed of light. And you're accelerating and approaching the speed of light, so they can never catch you up. And so you will see an effective, the other particles that hit you, you see them coming from this Rindler horizon. And this is this thing called Unruh radiation. So there is like a horizon effect as you approach the speed of light, but only if you're accelerating. Because if you're just moving at a fixed velocity, it doesn't have any meaning. Has Unruh radiation been experimentally detected? I don't know. I don't think that Hawking radiation has either. But you can actually make similar things happen in what are called these analog gravity systems. So the fundamental thing that's driving all of these phenomena is that the speed of light is constant and you cannot exceed it. So in any wave-like theory where there's a maximum speed, you could make the same things happen. It doesn't have to be the speed of light. So if there are these analog gravity experiments where people, they use like water and they essentially set it up so that the speed of sound in water is like the speed of light. And you can make systems where they have a horizon. So like you like make a plug hole and you spin something and there's some effective horizon. And if you observe it enough, you see Hawking radiation of water waves from the horizons in these systems. So the phenomenon can be observed, but only in analog systems, I think. But I'm not sure. I kind of also feel like maybe Rindler and Unruh radiation is related to Cherenkov radiation. I think, but I'm not sure. I feel like they might be related.
Wikipedia says that any of the disputed whether it's been observed.
Oh, Wikipedia says.
So some people say they have seen it in analog systems.
Right. I mean, I think people have definitely seen it in analog systems, and like, you know, to the extent that the maths is the same in both systems, yeah, it should happen. So there are horizons for particles in special relativity. The final thing I will talk about.
Oh, not to interrupt, but there was one question. I think it was the typical week of the theoretical.
That was the one I was just going to do.
Okay, good.
I was just going to do that one. What's the weekday in the life of a theoretical physicist? So I like to use the phrase that we just shoot the shit all the time, which we do, and it's fun. So what do I do most days? Come in the morning, do some emails, check the archive. The archive is this online repository of papers. It's kind of like Facebook for physicists. Like papers get posted every day, and you check the different feeds. So I check cosmology, and I see what papers have come out today. And I like mostly just read the abstract and maybe bookmark one for later. I check cosmology, I check high energy physics theory, I check particle physics. So you check your archive and you do your emails, and you do what everybody does, you fart around on Facebook and you do all of that. And then have some coffee and then you go for lunch. But what I spend most of my time doing is coding, actually. So a lot of problems that I want to solve, you can only get so far by writing down equations. I mean, so like we did this example with, you know, like Friedman equation's simplest equation in cosmology. And I could still only solve it analytically if I assume that there's only matter in cosmological constant. If I put in radiation, if I want to start talking about perturbations, the growth of structure, all of this, you've got to solve it on a computer. So I spend a lot of time writing code in Python and using Mathematica. So I spend some time writing some code. It's normally enjoyable if I have to make a nice, pretty picture. I'm really into making plots that look good, like this one. I'm really into making plots. It's fun. So I'll make some plots. I'll send some emails, have a Skype call with a collaborator maybe, and do some writing. I really like writing as well. So I like writing papers, you know, stringing the story together. What plots are you going to put in? How are you going to tell this story? Which equations do you show? Which ones don't you show because it's kind of boring? Reading papers, all this kind of stuff. So it's very nebulous. Everybody, you know, relatives are always like, what do you do all day? I don't really know. But then, like I said, we do shoot the shit a lot. That's good. So what, like an example is that, like, you know, I might go to Toronto, got some friends, stay over. What am I going to do the next day? I'll drop by to University of Toronto, where I know some people. And there's a visiting researcher here at PI who's also at Toronto called Wei Li Pen. And I like to shoot the shit with Wei Li. So I'll send him an email. I'll be like, Wei Li, I'm coming into U of T this morning. Are you going to be around? Yeah. So I'll go in, have a little chat with Wei Li. And the question is normally, what are you thinking about at the moment? And so Wei Li might say, I'm thinking about the relative velocity between dark matter and neutrinos. And he'll tell me about that, and he'll draw some pictures, and we'll write on the board. And I'll go, oh, that's interesting. And then I'll go away and sit down and do my emails for a while. And maybe I'll go, oh, there's actually something that linked my work and this relative velocity Wei Li was thinking about. So then I'll spend the next hour like making a plot. I'll like figure out how can I extract the data that I want from the code that I have and plot it in a way that represents this relative velocity. And then I'll make some nice plot. And then I'll go to Wei Li after lunch and I'll be like, hey, I was thinking about what you said. Here's how I think about relative velocity. And it might have something to do. And then we'll go, oh, that's interesting. What observations can we use? Here's some papers. Read this. Let's send each other an email and then go home. And pretty much every day is like that. Some days you have a seminar. Some days you don't. Sometimes you have a telecon on Skype. Some days you don't. And that's about it. Coding and shooting the shit. And reading.
Thank you very much. Love to continue. I just want to make sure people get to lunch. And
yeah, I need to get some lunch and get moving as well. Great.